Welcome to a recording of Titusville Free Methodist Church, a community planted in the forgiveness, freedom, and fullness of Jesus Christ. We thank you for your interest and pray that you are blessed as you listen to this relevant word.
Merry Christmas to you. It's good to see you. It's good to worship together this morning. You know, during this course of Advent, those words should not rhyme. You know, they just should not. We've been doing a series called The Songs of Christmas. And so, like every week, we've been looking at some of the biblical songs, the Song of Elizabeth and the Song of Zechariah. And next week, we're actually going to look at the Song of Simeon. And the second week of Advent, we just sang songs. That's all we did in here. We gathered in here on the second Sunday of December, and we called it the Christmas Extravaganza. And we sang all kinds of songs, including a lot of fun songs. Like we actually sang Frosty the Snowman, and we sang, I think, Have a Holly Jolly Christmas. I'm getting the head shake there. But you know, not all the songs of Christmas are fun songs. And some of you, maybe even most of us, are a little bit relieved to hear that. We can like lift this weight off of our soul that during the Christmas season, we always have to be merry and bright. Because that's not the case, is it? Everything isn't all merry and bright, despite the things that we hear when we turn on our stereos or we turn on our devices or we turn on our radios. These are the songs that come up, like the one I just mentioned, Have a Holly Jolly Christmas, It's the Best Time of the Year. Or how about Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas? Or how about Dashing Through the Snow in a One-Horse Open Sleigh? Or The Fields They Go, Laughing All the Way? Or how about It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year with the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you, be of good cheer? What if I don't want to be of good cheer, but everyone's telling me to be of good cheer? But don't you know it's the happiest season of all with those holiday greetings and gay happy meetings? Yeah, and on it goes. Or I'm dreaming of a white Christmas that ends with, may your days be merry and bright. But maybe not. Maybe your days aren't merry and bright, and maybe we're not laughing all the way, are we? So today we want to talk about not the happy songs of Christmas, but maybe like that very last carol that we sang, O Come, Come Emmanuel, some of the songs in Christmas are written in a minor key. This is one of those. Our song today is a song that's written in a minor key, and it's found in Matthew chapter 2. And this is a hard passage. I mean, it's just hard things happening here. So if you go to Matthew chapter 2, we're going to read the story and then hear the song. So Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod. Now there's more than one King Herod in your Gospels. This is King Herod the Great, and later on we have the Herod who beheaded John the Baptist. That's a son. So during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one to be born king of the Jews? Okay, these are surprising words to Herod because, hello, I'm king of the Jews. Where is the one to be born king of the Jews? We saw a star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. When he called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ, that is the Messiah, that is God's King, where was he to be born? And they replied, in Bethlehem in Judea, for this is what was written by the prophet. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. And as soon as you find him, report to me, so that I may go and worship him too. And the whole time he's just rubbing his hands together like this. After they heard the king, the Magi went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went on ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And on coming into the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So Joseph got up, took the child and the mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." Now when Herod realized he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and get this, Herod gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. And here's our minor key Christmas song for today. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. It is Rachel, weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. You know, all the good songs are in Luke. All the good songs are in Luke. "Hark, the herald angels sing." That's a Luke song. "Oh, little town of Bethlehem." That's a Luke song. "Away in a manger," definitely a Luke song. "Silent night" is a Luke song. Matthew doesn't know, seemingly, any of those songs. Matthew doesn't have Mary holding the baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and pondering these things in her heart. Instead, he has Rachel anguishing over her empty arms. Luke has the little town of Bethlehem lying still, and in the dark streets are shining an everlasting light. But in Matthew, what's in the dark streets of Bethlehem are soldiers marching down, looking, listening for baby boys. Luke has peace on earth, goodwill to men. Matthew has killing. Instead of silent night, we hear the sound of brutal soldiers banging on doors. And instead of lullabies, like "Away in a Manger," we hear screaming. The crying of babies and the screaming of mothers. It's Rachel weeping for her children. If you lived next door to Rachel, would you wake up the next morning and play "Holly Jolly Christmas" while your children, all girls or boys over two, while they merrily unwrapped their gifts? In Luke, we have trifling mention of the most powerful man in the world. The Roman emperors mentioned in Luke almost as a just an offhand comment. Caesar Augustus called for a census, playing right into God's hands so Mary and Joseph could get to Bethlehem. But he's really a minor character, is Caesar Augustus. But in Matthew, we have Herod striving mightily against God's plan and God's will. So who is this Herod fellow? Okay, I told you he was Herod the Great. Now, I hope you might remember that we learned during our Revelation series, you should be very wary of taking the ascription great, no matter who you are or what you do. But he took it. Herod the Great. And Herod, he was an excellent politician. So Herod is he's a client king in the emperor. Like he's not in competition with the Roman emperor. He serves at the Roman emperor's pleasure. But he serves as a king over a territory, Judea. And he is the king there. And he can do whatever he wants so long as he doesn't cross the emperor and so long as he pays proper tribute to the emperor. And so he does a lot. Like one of the really great things he did was in Jerusalem, the temple that was there before he came into power, well, it was actually called Zerubbabel's temple. It was the temple the exiles built when they came back from Babylon. And it was a poor excuse for a temple, to be sure. But Herod, he won the favor of the Jews by making it a beautiful, elaborate temple, something to rival the first temple, Solomon's temple. So he was an excellent politician, but he was a really bad dude. I mean, he was a bad, bad guy. Herod was a guy who, anybody who threatened his power, he killed. I mean, he could get away with it. Anybody who threatened his power, he killed. And that included three of his sons. Yeah, no kidding. Three of his sons, his favorite wife, which I'm not sure how that equates, but he had a favorite wife, and he had her done in. And then he killed his mother-in-law. I would never do that. He killed his... He was a bad guy. Like, Caesar Augustus just watched from Rome the things that Herod did, and humorously, in a way we can't explain, said, I'd rather be one of Herod's pigs than one of Herod's sons. The kind of guy that Herod was. He wouldn't abide any rival. He wouldn't abide any rival. Thus his plot to kill all the unborn babies. This was small potatoes for him, to kill all the babies, boys 2 years old and under, just to make sure he gets Jesus. That's Herod. Okay, where is Ramah? Where is Ramah? A voice is heard in Ramah. Where is it? Well, so actually, Ramah appears in the book of the prophet Jeremiah, and it references a location where the Jews were. This was about 500 years earlier than the time of Jesus. References the gathering place for the Jews when they were going to be carried into exile in Babylon. So they met there. What I want you to picture is picture Nazi Germany in the early years. Picture the emptying out of the Jewish neighborhoods. Picture the train stations where the Jews were herded to. Picture the train cars where men were put on one train and children in another train and mothers in another train, where families were being separated and torn apart, never to return. That's Ramah. That's the place where children are separated from their mothers, never to be reunited. A voice is heard in Ramah. It's Rachel. Who's Rachel? Rachel is the favorite son of Jacob. Jacob is the father of Israel. I mean, that's the name. Jacob became Israel. He had four wives and 12 sons. Rachel was his favorite wife. She only bore him two sons. But because she was Israel's favorite wife, she became like the figurehead mother of the nation. So Rachel is the mother of the nation of Israel. So what we have is the voice that's heard in Ramah is the nation's mother lamenting the tearing away of her children and them being killed. Now the song the song that we're looking at, just four short lines, a voice is heard in Ramah. It's Rachel weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. I guess that's five. Traditionally, this song is called The Slaughter of the Innocents. Now, I want to say that in reality, The Slaughter of the Innocents, it isn't one song. It's not a single song. It's more like it ought to be the title of an album, The Slaughter of the Innocents. And it's a multi-vinyl album, and the cuts on it are too numerous to mention, this being a single one. Like, we have our own cuts on this same album, don't we? Like, name a school, or name a business, or name a public venue where an active shooter has cut down people that he cannot name. It's the slaughter of the innocents. Name a clinic where an unborn but otherwise viable human life has been terminated. It's the slaughter of the innocents. Name any war-torn country where the children don't even know what we're fighting about and still they have to die for it. It's the slaughter of the innocents. Like, I'm telling you, there's a lot of bands who have covered this song. There's probably never been a period in history where the torturous song hasn't been played. I call it Away with Mangers, because that's the coldness with which Herod unleashed his despicable act. It's a common song, and in fact, the song is so common, you can't even find a historian in the first century who bothers taking note of this particular cover of the song. I mean, in reality, the historian would look at it and say, well, how many boys were actually killed? Like, only 12 or 15. Bethlehem's a small town, like smaller than Titusville, like 1,500 people. It's only like 12 to 15 baby boys under the age of two, maybe 30, but that would be a huge number. Did I say only? Like, you can't say that to a mother. Well, it's only 12 or 15. It's only one. You can't say that. This song in this season is so appropriate, because what we do, so it seems, in the Christmas season is if we have losses, if we have grief, if we have mourning, it's like we have to go into hiding. It's like we're not allowed to have a sense of loss. And one of the things that this song does for us is it gives us permission. I would say even more than that, it doesn't just give us permission. It instructs us to grieve your losses. Grieve your losses. That's your first fill-in, actually. Grieve your losses. Rachel is weeping for her children. She's weeping for her children. She can name her loss. I wonder if you're willing to do that. Are you willing to name your losses? What are the losses that you're weeping over? What are the losses that you're grieving? Or what are the losses that you're failing to grieve? What are you missing most? What are you missing most? Maybe it's a father or a mother. Maybe it's a spouse. Maybe it's a father who's here in body, but some form of dementia has so ravaged his mind that he's not the person you knew. And you're grieving that loss. Maybe it's a child. Or or maybe it's a child that's only been conceived in your dreams because you've been unable to conceive on your own. Maybe your loss is a house that was full of memories in every room and every corner, and somehow all those memories need to be squeezed into one small room in a nursing home. Maybe you miss being able. Like there are things you used to be able to do, but you just aren't able to do it anymore. And you grieve that. Maybe you grieve the loss of a job. Maybe you grieve the loss of a marriage. Maybe you grieve the loss of your health. And like you've been fighting a battle and you've been doing it bravely, but you know it's a losing battle. Maybe it's the loss of a dream, like a realistic dream. Like there was something that you definitely thought could be yours. You thought, this is definitely something I could do. This is definitely something that I could accomplish. But you've had to give it up. You've had to cross it off your list of things that you wanted to accomplish in life. And you're mourning that. Maybe you would be mourning a loss of innocence, however long ago that might have been. A loss of innocence that came through physical abuse, or a loss of innocence that came through sexual abuse, or a loss of innocence that came through an unspeakable betrayal in your life. Maybe your loss, maybe what you mourn, is a child to a miscarriage. Maybe something was taken from you. What are your losses? Would you be able to write them down and actually look at them? And it seems like Christmas accentuates our losses. I think business picks up at counseling offices at Christmas time. Christmas accentuates our losses. Last week, Tyler Brown preached a message on the Song of Mary, and what Mary says is, "My soul magnifies the Lord." And one of the things he was really careful to explain was that my soul doesn't make God bigger than he is, but to magnify the Lord brings him closer to me. And I want to say, well, that's all true for what Mary sang, that's right, but I want to say the holidays magnifies my pain. The holidays magnify my loss because it brings it closer to me. It shoves it right up in my face. And this song that Matthew includes for us gives us permission, even gives us instruction to grieve our losses. I don't know if you know this or not, but if you read in the book of Psalms, there's 150 Psalms. Half of them are songs of lament. I mean, songs of mourning and grieving. Songs of lament, or at least have verses of lament within the psalm itself. The Bible has an entire book called Lamentations. How important do you think grieving is in Scripture? There's an entire book called Lamentations. We hoist up the Sermon on the Mount and we think about the Beatitudes, but we seem to forget how those Beatitudes actually go. Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who mourn. Not cursed are those who mourn. And he didn't say, blessed are those who look at their pain or their losses and stuff it or deny it or suppress it or repress it or cover it up or make light of it or explain it away with some glib line like everything happens for a reason and you know there's always someone worse off than you. Okay, so there's one person that's not worse off, right? Like there's someone on the bottom of that ladder, that's all I ever want to say. But it doesn't really matter because you don't compare losses. Every loss stands on its own. It doesn't matter if someone's loss seems greater than yours. Your loss is your loss. And it stands on its own, and the song says, grieve your losses. grieve your losses. Learning to lament, learning to grieve our losses, and to do it well, helps prevent our preoccupations and our obsessions with entertainment and drugs and food and porn and sports and sex and television. One person said, I was seeking to end my pain through such things, but it only created more. It's okay to grieve your losses. In fact, it's good. It's good. Rachel grieved her losses, the mothers of Bethlehem. So the second thing this song instructs us in is to listen for the weeping of others. Listen for the weeping of others. Not everybody is singing a happy song at Christmas. Some are stifling cries of lament within their own soul. Their merry is a little bit dreary. They're not finding this to be the best or most wonderful time of the year, and they are definitely not laughing all the way. We need to listen for them. A voice is heard in Ramah. This is Ramah. There are voices here. A voice is heard in Ramah. It's Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted. That's such an important line. Refusing to be comforted. Why? Because a person wants to be heard before they're comforted. Listen, sometimes when we try to comfort another person, it's only for our own comfort and not theirs. Like, we're uncomfortable with their pain. And so we try to comfort them, but it's really us we're trying to comfort. Is that right, Bonnie? Yeah. So listen. Listen for the weeping of others. And they will say to you, at least in their heads, if not out loud, they will say to you, don't tell me not to cry. And don't tell me it'll be okay. Because right now, tears are all I have. And at the very least, it's not okay right now. We need to listen. Listen to the cries that are around us. Listen to those whose losses are so great. There's nothing you could put under a tree that would make up for it. You know, in Jerusalem, they have something they call the Wailing Wall. And the Wailing Wall, and I've never been there, but I want to say you don't need to know that, you don't need to go there to get this. The Wailing Wall is the western wall of the temple. It's the only remaining part of the structure of this very temple that I spoke of earlier about Herod. And so the Jews in Jerusalem go there to pray. They go there to pray. It's the Wailing Wall. They go there to grieve their losses. I want to say, as a church, we need a wailing wall. But you know what? I think we're that for each other. We need to be a wailing wall for each other, where a friend, a brother, or a sister in Christ can come to us and just weep on us without us having to utter one word by way of attempted comfort. Just to let them weep. Just to listen. Does that make sense? Like, we can do that. We can be that. We can be the wailing wall. Here's the last thing. I'm not going to finish this line right away, although there is a finish to it. But the other thing this song instructs us in is this. Losses are permanent. I'm going to finish that, but let's just stay there for a second. Losses are permanent. Why was Rachel refusing to be comforted? Because they are no more. Weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they're no more. And that child is not coming back. Losses are permanent. I think we have a hard time learning that, just because of how accustomed we are to how plots play out on television and movies and in other kinds of storytelling. So in my own life, my first deep experience of grief came in the loss of my mother. So I was 31 years old and she was 66. And I remember how this all played out when she died. Like in the months afterwards, there was this moment where I suddenly realized, oh, she's not coming back. And I know you would think, like, well, of course she's not. Like, why didn't you know that ahead of time? And it's like, I did kind of know it ahead of time, but somehow or other there's this thing that plays out in your mind where you go through everything you're supposed to go through. Like we met as a family, and we had the funeral, and we had the after-funeral stuff, and we had the period of mourning, and like, I don't know if you know this or not, but people have watches for mourning. And it's like, okay, time's up. All right, you need to get back on track. So you get back on track, even though you're not really done mourning. And like the last sympathy card has come in, and everything's over. Everything's over. And you think like, okay, so we're done with that. Like, we're done with that. And they didn't come back. But it's like, oh, losses are permanent. There is no coming back. Losses are permanent. Okay, here's how that line actually finishes. Losses are permanent until they aren't. Until they aren't. Look, we need to face our griefs, and we need to allow others to do the same. Not to deny them, not to sugarcoat them, but also not to be swallowed up and drowned in them. So the baby Jesus, whose birth we celebrate, he escaped this first attempt on his life. And he escaped other attempts on his life until the time was just right. And when the time was just right, he didn't try to escape the attempt on his life. When the time was just right, he gave up his life willingly. He laid down his life, and we believe that in the laying down of his life, that's when this great reversal began. He lays down his life, and he rises again. And in his resurrection, in his rising again, our losses become gains. Our deaths become life. However much our hearts ache, and we need to own the ache, but no, however much our hearts ache, we can have this like wry smile on our face. Seems a little bit paradoxical, but we can have this little wry smile on our face because we believe in a God who entered into our brokenness, absorbed the worst that it had to offer, and then on the third day he said, enough of this, enough of this. And he turns it all around. It's like putting the car wildly in reverse. And the seeds of the great reversal, the seeds of the great renewal, the restory, were not only sown, but actually began to sprout. Jesus is called a shoot from Jesse's stump. The tree was cut down, but a shoot comes up out of this stump. And now, for us, think about the Revelation series again with me, if you would. Now, like, it's within view. We can see it. This is what the word revelation means. Like, our losses are real and they're present, but we can look out at this horizon, and it's within view for us. This time when the losses that are permanent until they aren't, when God wipes away every tear. The day when everything is new. The day when there's no more, when there is no more mourning, when there is no more pain, when there's no more crying, and when there's no death. There is that day. And I want to leave you with this. Until then, until that day, may God grant us the grace to feel deeply our own griefs, as well as the suffering of those around us, and to wait on Him in this confusing in-between, and to let the old deaths birth new resurrections that He has for us. Losses are permanent until they aren't. I want you to pray with me, and we'll let the worship team make their way up very quietly. So I hope in this time that you've been able to be honest with the Holy Spirit, to reckon with your own losses, perhaps those losses that have not been properly grieved over. And I think that Jesus invites you in to let you weep before Him. And He won't even correct you. He won't even tell you, you know, buck up. You need to have a stiff upper lip here. He will not do that. The prophet Isaiah says, in all their affliction, He was afflicted. And then it says, and the angel of His presence came to them and lifted them up and carried them all the days of old. Friends, I don't know what losses you've dealt with in life, and maybe those losses have prevented you from having anything like a meaningful relationship with Jesus. I just want you to flip that around today. Your losses should be inviting you into a meaningful relationship with Jesus, because He has entered into your brokenness. He has died your death, and He offers you His life. And so even in the midst of whatever it is that you grieve, whatever it is you've lost, invite Jesus into your heart, into your life. Exchange, trade your hurts. For His freedom and for His life. And that happens, that can happen right at this table.
Thank you for listening. We invite you to visit our website at t3church.org to listen to our regular podcast and find out more about all that is T3 Church.